Okay, so our next talk by Zach is titled You Can't Spell DevShell Without Hell. So let's welcome our speaker.
Hello, thank you for having me. Like they said, you can't spell DevShell without hell. My name is Zach Mitchell. I'm an engineer at Flox, and I work primarily on the CLI, where one of our commands is Flox Activate, which is very similar to Mix Develop in the sense that it puts you into a developer shell. So what we're going to cover today is, first, we're going to dive into how Mix Develop works. Then what if we want more from it? So what if you want to use a different shell? What if you want it to be faster? That kind of thing. And specifically, how that's implemented in Flox Activate. And then you'll get this as we go along. There's not a dedicated slide for this, but you'll see why Fish is objectively the best shell. And thank you, thank you. I see I'm among my own people here. Okay, so to frame this whole thing, I wanted to discuss very briefly kind of what is the purpose of a dev shell. So generally, you have some dependencies. You want those to be found before anything else that's on your system, just natively. And so what does it mean to like find it? So in my mind, the observable universe to your shell kind of consists of both the file system and the environment. And so if you can control those, you can control what is observable from your shell. And so the strategy here, both for Nix Develop and Flox Activate, is to deterministically set the environment. That's where, you know, all the whole derivation machinery comes in. And then you can manipulate the file system via symlinks, also where derivations come into play. So we're gonna dive into Nix Develop right off the bat. So this is kind of a high-level overview of what the Nix Develop flow looks like. You're in your user shell, you type Nix Develop, and that forks off a new process. And what that process does is it obtains some kind of environment that's supposed to show up in your shell. We'll get into all the details of what that looks like in a minute. And then it's going to take that environment and create a RC script, run control, bash RC, that kind of thing. It's going to create an RC script to basically replace your shell's normal RC script. And once it has that, we're going to exec bash in this case. So for those of you that aren't familiar with fork exec and system calls like that, fork, create me a new process, exec, replace what that process is doing. So that's important to know the distinction because for many things, the parent-child process relationship is important. So let's get into some of the details. If you want to follow along in terms of seeing how this is implemented in code, I left these bullet points here so you can go explore for yourself. So we're not going to go look at these things today, but if you want to take a screenshot online or take a photo here to go follow that later, this is there for kind of self-directed learning. So we're going to start out with a bit of trivia, because this will show up in the kind of the design of Nix Develop, which is that Nix Shell and Nix Develop are primarily designed for debugging builds. They're not kind of designed from the ground up to be developer environments. And you can see that DNA because they both recreate the build environment of a derivation. And so you can kind of prove this to yourself by running build phase inside of a Nix Develop dev shell. So build phase is a script that is one of the many phases that happens during a Nix build. And so if you run that inside of Nix Develop, you'll see that it's defined to something. It probably won't work because, you know, you haven't run any of the preceding steps, but it is there. And so you can see that this is the Flox repository. I just did a Nix Develop there. And there's this huge error message because we haven't run any of the previous phases, but that shows you that build phase is defined there. Okay. So the first steps that happen when you run Nix Develop is that it kind of figures out what derivation you're talking about. So we're not going to get into those details, but say that you run Nix Develop foo, it finds the derivation that corresponds to foo. All right? So once you have that derivation, we're actually going to transform it. That's kind of the first meaty step in Nix Develop. So every derivation has a builder and a set of arguments to that builder. And so normally this is like some script Maybe you've defined it yourself. Maybe it's from one of the Nix packages, helpers, that kind of thing. But what we're going to do is we're going to replace those arguments with this other script called getInv. And so what this does is it basically exfiltrates the environment that would be present during that build. And so what it does when you build this derivation is it produces this JSON object that has a top-level bash functions key and a variables key. And inside of that, there are keys for every function that was defined, every environment variable that was defined, and then also for variables, it tells you what type it is. So this can be exported, it could be an array, it could be associative, blah, 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 all that kind of stuff. And so it does this line by line, which is kind of cursed because JSON, notably not a line-oriented data structure, it is tree-structured. So if we look at the script, I've cut out a bunch to simplify it and give you kind of a high-level skeleton view. First thing it does is run setup from standard div. And basically what this does is it populates path, CMake prefix path, stuff like that. Basically all the stuff that makes your dependencies available in your dev shell. And then the next thing it does is it dumps out all the variables and functions, and then it will run this dump env script. And this is what constructs that JSON object line by line. Again, cursed because this is not a line-oriented data type. And so this is where we started getting into like the gnarly stuff, because this is kind of a simplified snippet from the part that is basically parsing bash function definitions in bash. This is the tip of the iceberg. So I mean, you can see we're doing like regular expression matches where, you know, for printf, like there's the colon for the JSON separator, which brings us to our first encounter with hell. You can't see this because it is too bright in here, but that's hell. And so we're going to see a bunch of depictions from Dante's Inferno. This is one of them. It gets worse if you look at the part that kind of parses the variables. Don't read this, but basically you can just see that it's more, and the previous thing was ugly, so more ugly, bad. We're doing this whole like exported var array associative and I guess unknown. I'm not sure what an unknown variable type would be in bash, but this is where we're kind of switching on those types so that we can enumerate them. Also hell. I like this one because it looks like Satan is pouting, which I would also do. So if you want to see the full JSON representation from your Nix develop shell, you can run nix print devinv with the JSON flag, and you'll see, you know, this thing that I showed earlier. So once you have that JSON, what you're going to do is parse it into a build environment struct in the C++ code, which then translates it back to bash. So once you have that, you're going to apply some transformations to that environment to kind of build up this RC script. One of the things you'll do is you'll append this line that says eval shell hook. So if you define a dev shell with like make shell or something like that, and you define a shell hook, this gets appended to the end of this whole script so that you can customize things after you've done your kind of generic Nix develop setup. So we're going to dig into kind of these details next. Once you have that script, what you do next and how you transform it depends on how you're invoking Nix develop. So are you running just a command with it, so with a dash C flag or dash dash command, or are you putting yourself into an interactive shell? If it's just a command, you're going to do all this stuff and make the script, and at the end, you're just going to exec whatever the command was. So you're going to set up the environment and then just run a command with that environment present. If it's interactive, this is very important. You're going to prepend this line that says to source the user's bash RC. So that's very important because you want all of the Nix setup stuff to basically run last. Because if you do all your setup and then run the user's bash RC, that could set path to like a fixed value, or it could add something to path that puts something in the user system before all the Nix stuff. And at that point, you've kind of ruined things, because the whole point of Nix develop is to make sure that somebody running that gets exactly the same environment, exactly the same dependencies every single time. And so, again, you put the bashrc script first so that Nix basically gets the final say in what the environment looks like. Then at the very end, this is where we actually run or put you into the bash shell. So you exec bash with this RC file flag pointed at this script that we're building. And so what this does is it basically says, rather than running the user's bash RC, run this other script. You will still run the user's bash RC script because we have, like I said, just prepended that to the thing that we're building. So this brings me to kind of one of my pet peeves, which is that people who are kind of like new to Nix will like discover Nix develop, and they're like, well, what if I want to use Z shell? Or what if I'm enlightened and want to use Fish? And some people will say, well, just exec, that shell after you run Nix develop. So Nix develop dash C, that shell, which, as I've just explained, is wrong, because once you exec that shell, it will run that shell's RC scripts, which is notably after you've just done all of your Nix stuff. So that doesn't put you in the same environment as somebody who is just using bash. So that is broken. Don't do that. And don't recommend it. So now we get to get into some of the details that this script actually does. One of the first things that it does is it sets path and XCG data dirs, but it doesn't just obliterate their previous contents. For these two variables specifically, it will prepend to them. Because essentially, if you obliterate their current contents, nothing will work after that. So don't do that. Another thing that it does is basically points anything that looks like a variable defining the location of a temp directory to a new temp directory. And so if you do Nix develop and you echo temp, for example, you'll get something like nix-shell dot some gibberish. That is your new temporary directory while you're in Nix develop. This is fun to discover if you don't know that it exists. And you're wondering, like, why the hell are my files not where they're supposed to be? Another thing that it does is it will rewrite the outputs of that derivation that you transformed. So for instance, you normally have this variable out that kind of defines where you're going to put the output of your derivation. And normally this points at the Nix store. But if you're doing development, you don't want to accidentally, move something into out and just write gibberish to the Nix store. That would be bad. And so what the script does as we're building it is it rewrites those to point to somewhere else. And this happens to be basically in an outputs directory under your current directory. So for instance, if I go into the Phlox repo, Nix develop, and then echo what out points to now, it is basically, that's where my repo ends, outputs slash out. So this is actually pretty helpful if you're debugging a build. You can run one of your phases or whatever and go see what it actually put in there. Another interesting thing is that it involves itself with the garbage collection process. So it would be pretty shitty if you were in your development shell and one of your dependencies was garbage collected out from under you. You probably don't expect that to happen. So we have to make sure that all of our dependencies are in the right place, make sure that they stick around while we're in that shell. We also want to make sure that the script that we used to get into the shell doesn't get garbage collected. So the script sets this Nix GC root variable to the store path of the script. And I submitted a whole second talk on the garbage collector. There is all kinds of stuff in there, including, there's a whole server in there that listens on a socket for anything. Correct question. So we can talk about that later if somebody wants to know any cursed things about that. But one of the things that it does is it scans slash proc on Linux, looking for anything that's currently running that has store paths, either open as a file descriptor or something like that. And so this function is find runtime roots. If you want to go peer into the abyss. And so if you want to see what the actual script looks like, you can run this nix print devinf command. So previously we saw that with the JSON flag. This, without the flag, gives you just the script itself. Another way to do this is to build the dev shell output of a flake and just go look at what its contents are. So now we get into flox activate. So we've prepared that script with nix develop. You exec bash with this RC file. That's honestly, having worked on flox activate, refreshingly simple. Flox activate has a different set of goals. So we want the same reproducibility as nix develop, but we also want to support different shells. Currently, we support bash, Z shell, fish, and TC shell. We also support two different closures. We support like a develop and runtime mode. So this is kind of similar to nix develop versus nix shell, where this runtime mode kind of just puts stuff in path. We also want faster activation. So with nix develop, currently you evaluate the derivation that puts you into that shell. And even if that is like cached in some way, it's still not super fast. So for the flox dev shell, it is several seconds, which is not excellent. But we'll get to that in a minute. Additionally, flox activate supports this idea of like layered activations. So you can activate multiple environments at a time. So this is cool for context switching. We also want to share some resources between activations. So say that you activate an environment in multiple tabs. There are some things that we want shared between those, namely services. And another thing we want to support there is when you close those tabs, we want those services to be automatically shut down. So finally, this is just kind of a nitpicky detail, but we want your path to be kind of tidy. So if you do a nix develop and then you look at path, you have a store path in there for every dependency that has like a bin directory, whereas with flox activate, you have one directory. So this is the high-level flow for flox activate. So there's a lot more going on here, so we're not going to be able to get into the same amount of detail. But contrast that with nix develop, flox activate, nix develop, flox activate. It's more complicated. At its core, it's doing something very similar, where you have your user shell, you fork off the flox process, and then we exec bash. But this isn't the shell that we're going to put you into. Since we support multiple shells, we kind of separate the activation process into the shell agnostic parts and then the shell specific parts. So for the shell agnostic parts, we use bash here. And this uses a tool called flox activations, which we'll get into in a little bit. That talks to some state that we keep around. This is basically just stored as like JSON on your file system somewhere. We also have this flox watchdog process, which is kind of doing this monitoring to see, you know, how many tabs you have open with this environment in it, so we know when to shut things down. This used to be called Klaus, after one of our coworkers' French bulldogs, that was too much whimsy for some people. So RIP Klaus, lost but not forgotten. This also is responsible for shutting down your services. Let's get into it. One of the primary ways that this is completely different from nix develop is that everything is built ahead of time. So when you build a flox environment, everything that's necessary to run your dev shell is basically already there. This is eagerly built when you run flox commands that modify the environment, or if you manually edit your config file. We call it a manifest. This is just a TOML file we'll see in a second. If you make manual edits to that, rather than going through the flox edit command, we'll detect that and then rebuild next time you run any flox command that needs it. So if you want to see what this looks like, we have this .flox directory. Inside of it, there is this manifest.toml. And then in this run directory, we have these two symlinks. People are moving the projector up there. We have these two symlinks, and these point to basically our two different closures. So this .dev points to the kind of nix develop style dev shell, and then run is the more nix space shell. I don't know how you're supposed to say that in a more elegant way other than Nick's space shell and Nick's dash shell. Somebody inform me at some point. Okay, so if we follow those symlinks into the store, we see this. This is the contents of your environment. And so another primary way that this is different is that we basically recursively merge your entire closure into this directory. So for instance, this bin directory is the merged bin directories of the entire closure. Same thing for lib, share, include, etc. And then there's a few other things that we kind of sprinkle in here for our own purposes. Namely, this activate script, which is kind of, somebody's having fun next door. This activate script, and then some kind of like helper scripts to go along with it. So this is what gets run when we kick off Phlox activate. So when I talk about immediate activation, what do I actually mean? So basically what I'm showing here is a comparison between running the true command by absolute path, so that there's no shenanigans about running shell built-ins. So first with Phlox activate, and this is in fish, and that takes 50 milliseconds to basically put me in the shell, run the command, and then get back out. So doing that without activation, just running it in my normal fish shell, takes 16 milliseconds. So that's a difference of 40 milliseconds for Phlox activate, much faster than a few seconds, right? So that's pretty nice and one of my favorite features. And this is what basically building things ahead of time allows you to do. So like I said, there's no evaluation on the way to activation. And depending on what your dot files look like, the rate limiting step can be either Phlox or not Phlox, depending on what your dot files look like. And so 40 milliseconds is kind of quick enough. It's not zero, but there's low-hanging fruit there that we can trim some time off of that if we feel like it's a priority. And so I figured that all out kind of by writing a profiler, as you do. So I wrote this with BPF trace to track fork and exec and exits. And it's broken in various ways, so it's not super useful at the moment. But basically what this does is it spits out mermaid syntax for Gantt charts. And that looks like this. And so one of the weird limitations of mermaid syntax is that the smallest possible time that you can represent is 1 millisecond. So all these blocks look like the same amount of time, and in reality they are very much not. So essentially what you're seeing here is we start Phlox activate. This is doing something in fish. This is actually running activation with the RC file that we've prepared. This is kicking off a background check to see if you have like upgrades available for your packages. This is the watchdog getting spawned and waiting for things to exit. But yeah, so that was pretty cool. Another thing that's kind of different about our architecture is that we have two different shell hooks, or two different sets of shell hooks. So we have, in our manifest, we have this hook section, and the only thing in here is called onActivate at the moment. So this runs in the bash shell in the kind of shell agnostic part. Then we have this profile section that has one entry for each shell, and then a common entry that will run in all of them. And this is run in, basically, this gets injected into the RC script for your user shell. And so this allows you to set things like aliases in your shell. So that's pretty handy. We also have this idea of starting versus attaching to an activation. Starting an activation basically does the whole thing. And then attaching to it will kind of replay diffs of the environment. And so basically what happens during activation is we kind of take snapshots of the environment at various points, and then we will kind of compare those to compute these diffs. And so we do that because you can tell users all you want that, oh, this should be idempotent because we might run it more than one time. Okay. Same thing with this. You can tell users all day this is idempotent, or it should be idempotent, so write it a certain way. And they won't. So basically, we want to make sure that we can run things as few times as possible. One way to do that is to kind of just compute their effects, which for you functional programming nerds is a thing that you care a lot about. But yeah, so we take those snapshots and we can apply them. That's what kind of attach means. So if we come back to our diagram, the next thing I think we're going to look at is, this watchdog. So like I said, we want to keep track of essentially how many instances of an environment are active right now. So basically, how many shells do you have this thing running in? And that is the job of Flock's watchdog. Like I said, activation state, this is kind of where we store all those snapshots of the environment and their diffs. We also keep some information about, I think this is also where we keep the socket for being able to talk to your services. Another thing that we have to keep in mind here for our architecture is that layering is a thing that we explicitly support. And so you need to keep track of which other environments have been activated. And so that adds kind of a significant amount of complexity because you always need to make sure that environments get added to the right variable, or directories get added to the right variables, that kind of thing. So as I mentioned before, that activate script is written in Bash, and that is kind of the shell agnostic part of activation. And then we defer all the shell specific parts to the very end in the kind of shell specific RC files. One of the things that the activation script does is it sets Flock's emptors, which is how we keep track of which other environments have been activated in this shell. And then it sets path, man path, stuff like that. One of the tricky parts of doing this is that if you support multiple shells, you need to kind of ensure that they have consistent behavior. And if you need to support an arbitrary number of shells, they each have their own dialect with different quoting rules, array support, rules for source and eval, et cetera. It gets pretty gnarly. So that's a big, difficult problem, which brings us back to hell. So that brings us to the abyss. So this is a Notion page that I created internally with bangers like Python. That command, it does not do what you think it does. Notably, this whole shell idiosyncrasies section. So let's get into that. Bash and Z Shell support hieroglyphics. I debated on asking whether anybody in the audience understood what this means, like these two invocations. And then I thought, anybody that raises their hand has probably experienced enough trauma that let's not out them like that. You basically just quote everything possible until it goes wrong, because if you do it the other way around, you'll run into the it goes wrong part immediately. So it's just kind of defensive quoting of everything. TC shell has no equivalent of this particular hieroglyphic, which basically all that does is it defaults to an empty string if this foo variable is unset or null, which is a simple way of saying, if it has a value, gimme. If it doesn't have a value, empty string. So TC shell has no real equivalent for that. TC shell, so when you do these kind of create an RC script things, one of the things you end up doing a lot is evaling the output of another command. Maybe because that other command has built up some shell syntax for you or shell code for you. If you want to leave yourself notes about what it has generated, one idea would be to emit comment lines. Don't do that in TC shell. oftentimes, it won't treat it as a comment character, in which case you'll get something that looks like this, which is really confusing if you don't know that this happens. Other times, it will say, okay, cool, that's a comment character, but so is literally everything else that comes after this, regardless of whether there's a semicolon or a new line. So just don't do that. TC shell sometimes just won't let you quote something. So this one, kind of makes sense in, you're already inside double quotes, so, other double quotes won't work. So TC shell has this thing called modifiers that you can put after the variable. So in this case, it's colon and a lowercase q. And that basically tells TC Shell, I can't write double quotes here, but do the quoting for me anyway. Just kidding, that doesn't work in backticks like we needed somewhere. I don't think I showed it. Whatever, right here, yeah, right here. So you can't use colon Q right here, which is kind of like exactly where you needed it. So new versions of TC Shell, as of 2021, have a capital Q, right? So like I said, that's only new versions of TC Shell. And so if you're using TC Shell, I don't know how frequently you're updating that anyway, so I don't know if this is like a thing that you even know about. Hell. We're back to hell. Okay, TC Shell doesn't have an internal field separator variable, so like if you have a path variable and you want to separate it into an array, you can't do that without doing other stuff that's just like not natively supported. Ask me how I know. Z Shell, we're going to stop picking on TC Shell now. Z Shell has both fpath and fpath. So these are basically path, but instead of for like executables, it's for shell functions. And so they actually both refer to the same quantity. They're kind of just different representations. So lowercase fpath is a space-separated array. It's a like a shell array. And uppercase fpath looks basically like path, so it's colon-separated. If you set lowercase fpath, you're all good. If you set uppercase fpath, basically Z Shell says, oh, you've set it to something? That means you know exactly what's supposed to be in there, and I won't load anything else. So basically, when you go to create a new Z Shell subshell, you'll lose all of the default ones from your system. Cool. Fish, I don't really find these a problem, but I figured I just had to include a slide on fish so I wasn't like the most biased. So everything in fish is essentially a list or an array. That's what they call arrays. And so if you quote path, you get a different thing from if you don't quote path. Basically, this one is a space-separated array. This one looks like what you expect path to look like, colon-separated. Fish prompt is a function. It is not the format string itself. It is a function that, when executed, produces the format string, which is like kind of neat in the sense that you can execute it, save its output, and then wrap something around that. So that's nifty if you want to like put something in front of the shell prompt or something like that. Startup files. This is so validating to hear everybody groaning at the same time. Z Shell has a lot. So really it has 10, but two of them are not startup files because it's like Z logout. So you have under both Etsy and the home directory, you have Z Shell RC, Z Shell Env, and Z profile, and Z login. So you have a copy of those under Etsy and the home directory, and then you have the same thing for login versus logout. Different ones of those get run depending on whether you are a login shell or not, or an interactive shell or not. Apparently, macOS doesn't really have a concept of a login shell, but it like fakes like it does. So basically, everything is a login shell or something like that. I don't know. I learned that at one point and then intentionally forgot. Bash is kind of similar in the sense that there's like profile, bash RC. Those get loaded in different contexts. Fish, my beloved, basically has config.fish, and there's one like under Etsy. Love it. I didn't count for TC Shell. I said that I'm an engineer at Flox. My other title, this is on LinkedIn as well, is the official Flox meme lord. We're not done. So fish, like I said, objectively the best shell. So all that stuff is super complicated. Just based on the diagram, you can see that it's complicated, much more complicated than NixDevelop. So I wrote a debugger. So this is written with the Ratatouille crate in Rust, which is relatively nice to work with. One of the nice things about this is that you can use it to kind of explore environment variables. So over here you have a list of variables, and then this is kind of the view. So the default is just viewing it as a raw string. And another thing you can do is split it so that you can kind of peek at these individually. So that's nice if you're like, wow, my brain kind of glazes over when I see that. What if I wanted to see it in a way that I could actually interpret? Wow, that's cool. Okay, that's first in path. I forgot. This also has the ability to walk a stack trace in your shell. Shells have stack traces. Did you know that? You do now. So it's also kind of broken. You can see that the screen is like kind of corrupted here. I don't know what that's about. But this is kind of cool because you can go see like, okay, I was in that file on this line, this file on that line, blah, 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 blah. So it's cool when it works. Okay, back to Flox Activate. So I mentioned that, you know, this is complicated to do consistently across many different shells. So the big difficult problem, doing that all consistently, the tractable problem is to implement the business logic in as few languages as possible. So we have Bash for the shell agnostic parts, and then we have this other tool, Flox Activations, where we need to do something kind of consistently across multiple shells. And the nice thing about that is that problem kind of reduces to emitting, you know, variable exports or source this other file. And that's pretty consistent across shells. There's different syntax, but the semantics are pretty similar. So like I said, this is that Flox Activations tool. We have a couple of functions in here. Basically, this acts as most like as closely to a pure function as possible, intentionally, so that it's kind of easier to debug. So here we have basically set environment directories. You tell it which shell you want to emit syntax for. This one is saying basically fix up path and manpath. We don't have time for this, but manpath is its own monster of where you put colons. So if you want to debug something that's happening in that activation script, you can just run Flox Activations directly. So for instance, if I want to see what it's going to do for path and manpath, I just say, okay, tell me about bash. Pretend that that's an environment directory that I already have activated. Pretend like that's what path already looks like. Pretend that manpath is empty. And then it just prints out this because it's going to source that output in our bash shell. So that's really nice for being able to kind of divide and conquer. Okay, back to activation. What was I about to talk about? Starter attach, yeah. So this is kind of going back to this activation state. We have, as I mentioned, we have these two different hooks. Hooked on activate might do something expensive, so we don't want to do that every time you activate. So we take snapshots along the way, create diffs of those snapshots so that we can basically just apply them later. Flox has built-in support for services. So this is like a database, web server, whatever. You define this in your manifest, basically just like a command. The thing that's responsible for shutting them down is that watchdog that I mentioned earlier. And this is also hell. So it turns out to be surprisingly difficult to find out when a process has terminated without race conditions, and actually not just race conditions, but also actually finding out. So if you just Google this, or whatever your search engine of choice is, you'll see recommendations for like kill-0, which is wrong, because it doesn't really differentiate between running processes and zombies. So if you're waiting for everything to be shut down before you run your cleanup stuff, you'll just wait forever because something hasn't cleaned up a zombie. So that doesn't work. Also, this relies on polling, which is a race condition. Something could reuse a PID between two invocations of kill-0. Tail-f is another thing that you'll see recommended, which often just uses kill-0 under the hood and has the same problems, so that doesn't work. On Linux, you can read /proc. That is just a race condition and isn't available on macOS, obviously. So what do? You find yourself in hell again. So the solution is you basically have to use platform-specific APIs. So Linux has this thing called PRCuttle, which
Zach,
is like...
I'm really sorry. Here. Over here. You've got 5 minutes left.
Okay. Just yeah, there's a timer.
Four
right.
Questions, usually.
Yeah, we're almost done. PRCuttle is process control. You can set something called a child subreaper, which is basically... rather than a process being orphaned and like reparented to like init or something like that, say no, reparent it to me, even if I'm not its direct parent. You can also say when something is terminated, send a signal to me. So that's kind of how you do that on Linux. On macOS, you have KQ, which is used for all kinds of things, but one of the things you can use it for is you can subscribe to exit notifications. And that kind of corresponds to just polling a file descriptor. And there's no race condition with that poll because the events are written to that file descriptor, so you basically won't lose them. Finally, you prepare that RC file. This looks kind of similar to the NixDevelop case, but we don't have time to go into like all the specific details. I mentioned that Z Shell has a million startup files, which makes it very annoying. But that's where we'll leave things. Thank you for your attention. Thank you for validating me and my pain. If you want to find out more, you can reach me at these links. You can find Phlox up there. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Zach, for the great talk. Any questions? Let's start over here.
On the schedule, I couldn't find the presentation. Will it be available later on?
It will be available. I just haven't uploaded it.
So I was wondering, like, for normal things, there are some things like plugins to let you use fish or whatever in the shell. Do you have, like, a preferred one out of those?
Do I have preferred plugins for fish?
For NixDevelop, for being able to use fish as your shell. Like, there's Nix anywhere in the world.
I use Home Manager. I don't actually use any plugins for fish, actually.
I mean, like, to use fish in NixDevelop.
Oh, I don't. Oh,
okay.
For those exact reasons that I mentioned, it's kind of broken.
Hey, thanks for the great talk. I was kind of curious on two things. One, if there was Phlox support for Durem, such that you can like just CD in. And the other one was that Durem does have like a use Nix and use Flakes, and you could still use Fish. I was kind of curious if you had any idea on the differences between that and Phlox.
So I don't use Durem, so I don't know that I can speak to a lot of the details. I do know that it causes some breakage with Phlox in some cases, because I think one of the ways that Durem works is it kind of takes environment snapshots rather than like running a script every single time, something like that. I could be wrong about that because I don't use it, but that's caused us some problems in the past. But we have an open issue about this on GitHub to have better support for it, so it's something that we're aware of.
Cool, thanks.
Any more questions? No? Oh.
Might we see more shells later on in Phlox, apart from those that are currently supported?
Sorry, could you ask that again? I couldn't hear.
Might we see more shells apart from the four that are currently supported, like maybe new shell support if it eventually stabilizes?
It's something that we've heard about. Like, people have asked us about new shells specifically. I don't know, like, on an infinite timescale, yes, we will support other shells, but I don't know where that lands on the roadmap. Because supporting activation, like Phlox Activate, turns out to be kind of one of our main maintenance burdens. So adding a new one, especially one that's not like super duper widespread, is kind of tough. Even Fish is way, this pains me to say, but is way less popular than either Bash or Z Shell. Those two are kind of like almost 50-50 in terms of usage from what I've seen. Fish is like a few percent. I do what I can, but I can't do that much.
All right, thank you.
any more questions? But we are almost out of time. One more? No? Oh, yeah, sorry, no, we're not going to make that. Then thank you for the great talk. Let's give a round of applause for Zach. Thank you.